We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Comstock. Today we're going to be looking at a book, although it never made it to book form. It's the manuscript of the late Maureen Heaton, her manuscript, The Impossible Dream. You can find this on a PDF file on AmericanDeception.com. That's Sam Iserbeet's site. His mother and Sam are fierce fighters against the dreaded Soviet-style government school system, which has basically usurped, completely taken over our public school system. But the Iserbeets have been valiant fighters in this for a long time. And they knew Maureen Heaton, who finished this book, I believe, in 1990, and sadly passed away before she could get the chance to publish it. Here is what a little blurb from Sam Iserbeet's AmericanDeception.com site, what it says about Maureen Heaton and her manuscript, The Impossible Dream. It says, "The late Maureen Heaton's manuscript of The Impossible Dream, which has never been widely disseminated. Heaton was a first-class patriot who spent every day of her life for at least 40 years researching the development of the Soviet system of management, which was piloted first in California, aka PPBS, and is now being used by every governmental agency at every level for total control of the citizenry." Now, it looks to me like this manuscript might go into the scope of this manuscript might go into more than just education, and that is news to me, so this is going to be interesting. Anyway, here we go. The Impossible Dream by the late Maureen Heaton. Forward. This book is about an elitist dream as old as Plato, a dream of power. Power stolen from those in whom it was vested in the beginning, and transferred to self-appointed would-be rulers of the world. But it is more than that. It is about the strategies being used to transfer that power. But it is much more than just that, too. It is about sedition and conspiracy, but much more than that, too. It is about the basic who, what, when, why, where, and especially how of a non-military assault against lawful conduct of public affairs carried on under the cover of a seemingly voluntary change in the way the government of the United States operates. But it is more than that, too. This book is about revolution. For any fundamental change in the way a nation is governed is revolution. That this is revolution is a recognized fact in the working papers of those who are in charge of the changes demanded by the revolutionary goal. This book is about the methods being used to bring about that goal. It is particularly about means to counter that revolution. There is a growing body of Americans who have become aware that their future is threatened by a monstrous evil abroad in the world. Lacking knowledge of the hidden agenda, they are firing at the visible evidence of it, but they are not touching the cause of that evil. There is also a growing segment of the American people who think it is too late to do anything about it. Well, I might count myself among those. Except for saving souls. It's not too late to do that. No one, except the Lord himself, knows when it is too late. While there is even a remnant of resistance still able to function, the final curtain has not fallen. Unless and until every human being and all the assets of this world are under complete control of the revolutionaries, this unholy war is still not over. Maybe it won't be even then, while any spark of liberty still burns in the hearts of the conquered. There may be a real difference in concept of things known, which brings to the facts an altered perspective. In my opinion, that is the key to turning back the red tide now inundating the world, and was the determining factor in the articles selected for inclusion in this report on the impossible dream. Concept may also be the key reason why, until now, there has not been any demonstrable success in the heroic efforts which have been made to interdict this assault on civilization in the past. Hopefully, exploring the strategies which have advanced this revolution will trigger original thinking about future offensive moves. While this book is primarily targeted for activist resistors already in the field, the consummate tragedy of today is that there is a great majority of the American public who do not have the vaguest idea of what is planned for their futures. What an army they could be if they but knew what is in this book. Those who have locked horns in the past with the perpetrators of such crimes against humanity, against nature, and nature's God are a minute fraction of those who should, could, and would resist if they had an inkling of what the future holds. Unless there is such resistance. What has gone before is but a prelude to the reality which lies ahead unless this revolution is stopped. An important strategy the revolutionaries have used to achieve an altered public concept has been the unreported redefinition of familiar terms. Sweet, she's going to get into some Orwellian language here. Some semantic deception. Okay. Democracy, says Maureen Heaton, is one of the altered perceptions which have allowed the progress of this revolution. The founding fathers of these United States knew full well and expounded on the nature of democracy and were explicit in denial of a democratic form of government for the nation being formed. They gave us a republic, if we could keep it, quote unquote. Which we haven't done too well in recent years. In large part, this is due to the role assigned to the quote-unquote democracy by the revolutionaries. Quote-unquote revolution itself is another term which has been redefined. In the minds of most Americans, revolution immediately brings to mind the heroic struggle which resulted in creation of the United States of America, or, alternatively, the bloody coup in Russia. Modern dictionaries suggest that any change in political form is revolution, even with the consent of the governed. Historically, revolution indicated overthrow of a government without lawful process. The revolution now taking place is of the redefined genre. It is rarely violent, as of this writing in 1990, and is being conducted at this stage within the halls of government itself. A basic strategy is the achievement of an apparent, quote-unquote, consent of the governed. Recognition that this is revolution, and that there is no valid, quote-unquote, consent, are of the essence. If there is to be a stop put to it. These pages are mainly composed of articles written by me, which appeared in a number of independent newspapers and or reports over a period of years. Most of my columns were prompted by some current event, which I considered had special significance. Some, though, were written to call attention to previously neglected or hidden acts of subversion. Some columns had a timely aspect, which no longer has meaning. In such a case, if the remainder of the article is pertinent to this work, modified versions are included. In some cases, updates are added, where a showing of continuity seemed needed. All of my work is supported either by original research or by personal experience, frequently by both. While some of the facts may be familiar territory to some of you, I early learned that there is no substitute for exploring the fountainhead from which current events have sprung. Often the facts are the least product of my research. Far too often, seminal evidence is present at the source, which, had it been properly evaluated, could have been a lodestar for resistance, then, before these events became accomplished fact. Much of that evidence exists in the strategies which have been devised to support the revolutionary moves. It is my conviction that successful interdiction of this revolution must come in the strategic arena, destroying the process before the objective is obtained. For those areas already conquered, new strategies must be developed. Be advised that what is presented here is a minuscule portion of the enemy arsenal. It is exemplary, but not comprehensive. Throughout these pages, whenever it is necessary to use one of the terms which now have definitions other than those historically understood, they are put between single quote marks. Some of these are defined at the end of the chapter in which they first appear. Some are not, because the meaning is evident. Where such a word is used in its historical sense, it is not marked. Another perception which has been encouraged as a revolutionary tactic has to do with the goal of this revolution. Hairs have been split over patriotic resistance to quote-unquote socialism or quote-unquote communism, both of which have been perceived as an apparent goal of this worldwide revolution. More real than apparent is the true goal, evidence in every revolutionary move, implicit in every program promoted, actualized in every conquered land, and explicitly stated in early documents directly attributable to the Matoids who dreamed this impossible dream. That true goal is a return to feudalism. Wow. She nailed it. She's right. She's totally right. That's exactly where this is going. Communism is the deception. It's part of the Hegelian dialectic. They're bringing it back to feudalism. And boy, does that ever tie in to Rome. Oh boy. Okay, back to the book. The true goal, never mind communism, is a return to feudalism. with the revolutionaries in total control of all the resources of the world, including what they have identified as quote-unquote human resources. Since the communist-socialist smokescreen blurred my own vision for many years, I have nothing but empathy for those who haven't yet broken through the obfuscation. With this introduction, and a prayer that this book will fulfill its intended function, let's get to it. Signed, Maureen Heaton, 1990. And Maureen Heaton now includes a quote from Daniel Webster. It's one paragraph long. Other misfortunes may be borne, or their effects overcome. If disastrous war should sweep our commerce from the ocean, another generation may renew it. If it exhaust our treasury, future industry may replenish it. If it desolate and lay waste our fields, still, under a new cultivation, they will grow green again and ripen to future harvests. It were but a trifle, even if the walls of yonder capital were to crumble, if its lofty pillars should fall, and its gorgeous decorations be all covered by the dust of the valley. All these might be rebuilt, but who shall reconstruct the fabric of demolished government? Who shall rear again the well-proportioned columns of constitutional liberty? Who shall frame together the skillful architecture which unites national sovereignty with state rights? Individual security and public prosperity. No, if these columns fall, they will not be raised again. Like the Colosseum and the Parthenon, they will be destined to a mournful, a melancholy immortality. Bitterer tears, however, will flow over them than were ever shed over the monuments of Roman or Grecian art. For they will be the remnants of a more glorious edifice than Greece or Rome ever saw, the edifice of American liberty. Daniel Webster. And now, Chapter 1 of Maureen Heaton's manuscript, The Impossible Dream. Chapter 1, A World in Chaos. History is a story of the lives of men. Sometimes a single life makes a never-to-be-forgotten mark on a short span of time. More often, the works of many lives are strung together through the years, carving a recognizable, continuing path to destiny. Sometimes, lives are intertwined, leaving a definite pattern as they move through time. Sometimes, lives parallel each other. Sometimes, paths cross. The lives themselves, however, would leave no impression on history but for the impact they have on time. This ability to impact is one element which separates man from the lower animals, an important factor in denial of the theory of evolution. All the animals which have existed since time began, singly or in concert, have made no imprint on the course of history or time. A single man can, and often does. Whether that impact is good or evil is not a matter of judgment. Even were there no decalogue, no gospel, there is a scale on which to weigh the actions of men. That scale exists in the laws of nature, and every normal-born person is equipped with an interface with nature's universal laws. Man's measuring device is called conscience. The capability of recognizing violations of nature's laws held man on course before writing was developed. From the beginning, that course, as a general rule, was upward, out of ignorance and the earthy life of physical dominance, to knowledge and mental dominance. Natural law was implicit in the Ten Commandments and in the precepts of Christ, as well as in the teachings of all religious leaders of heroic stature. When operative, natural law leads to peace, progress, and prosperity. In nature's system of law, it is not intent which is the determinant of good and evil. It is, rather, how an act affects nature itself. It is a practical impossibility for one man's mind to determine the intent of the mind of another. If an act violates natural law, it is evil, no matter the intent. That is the scale on which the actions of those who accept or assume power and authority must be weighed. Violation of natural law results in corruption, confusion, and chaos, and the results identify the nature of the act. The golden rule, a natural law, expressed in such thoughts as, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you," and, "As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master." These extend individual values beyond self to all mankind. To some, this rule is a lodestar lighting their path. To others, it is a still, small voice, easily overlooked, usually just when most needed. Not only is there natural law, there is also its opposite. Both have magnetic pull. Character is built by resistance. If the resistance is to natural law, the ability to resist evil decreases with each offense against nature, strengthening immorality. When the resistance is to unnatural law, as is the case when a firm stand is taken with conscience, then strong moral character results, gaining strength with each encounter. Viewing the state of the world today in the light of the lives of those who have taken leading roles in the resistance to natural law, the immensity of the evil growing by what it feeds on is only too evident. It is not anarchy holding sway today, it is chaos. The inevitable result of resistance to natural law, men with power succumbing to the pull of unnatural law, each past lesser evil numbing conscience a little more, the accumulated amorality widening the gap between them and conscience. Their perfidy is contagious. It pollutes the morals, character, and conscience of all who are drawn into their schemes. It can even taint the lives of non-participants. The tragedy so visibly engulfing the world today did not just happen. It is the natural outcome of the actions of a comparative handful of conscienceless men, aided and abetted by hordes of greedy collaborators. One of the saddest aspects of their results of their treachery is that this tragedy was made possible by the miracle of a country built on the premise of adherence to natural law. Without the progress of civilization, which resulted from the United States of America being placed under the control of a constitution constructed on natural law, and the leadership of men of conscience who developed the means to permit natural law to be operative, the freedom to willfully exercise unnatural law would have been severely circumscribed. The only possibility of reversing the reign of terror so palpably ahead lies in recognition by those still in tune with natural law that resistance to the planned destruction of individual and national sovereignty must be active and of equal or better force than the supporting unnatural law and usurped dominion. Those who have opted out of this struggle between good and evil do not recognize that, by non-resistance, they have taken their own first step against natural law and opened the way to further depredation. You hear that, you 501c3 hireling pastors? further depredation, which will not only impact these times and all time to come, but inevitably their own immortal souls. It is with the hope that the information presented here will fortify the present resistance, restore incentive to the disheartened, and stimulate renewed determination to neutralize the evil forces now usurping the rights of all mankind, that this information is being offered. Chapter 2. The Affairs of Men. Since time began, part of man's endowment from his Creator has been an insistent urge toward bettering himself. Born with original sin, and given free choice, the majority throughout history have taken the path which leads to improvement. This innate urging brought man from the caves which were his first dwellings to the skyscrapers of today, and everything in between. Whenever the majority have neglected this urge, the result has been, at best, chaos. At worst, regression. It was this urge which led man from lonely prowling of the fields or jungles for food and shelter to join his fellow men in primitive forms of governing, from tribal situations to more structured cooperation, as evidence in Mesopotamia and Egypt, and on to the definitive governments of Greece and Rome. This creative urge undergirded progress. Through the Dark Ages, to the bright hope of the cultural, scientific, and industrial advances realized by the creation of the United States of America, man made most progress when this urge was least impeded, internally or by outside forces. It is a perversion of that natural urge which prompts the quote-unquote rulers and the would-be rulers of the world to increase their health and power by usurping their unalienable birthright of liberty from those they can control. When knighthood was in flower, despite song and story, mankind in general was in servitude. The knights, their ladies, the kings and queens, the feudal lords, they all enjoyed their luxuries at the cost of the blood, sweat, and tears of the quote-unquote human resources which supplied their wants. In return for serving their lieges, the minions were permitted to live and to feast on the crumbs from the full tables of their masters. History is a record of the unceasing struggle between man yearning to be free and might, determined to control that freedom. The chess game played by those who proclaim a quote-unquote divine right over their fellow men has left rivers of blood on every continent, and that chess game goes on today. The combines which operated in days of old downplayed the suffering of the peasants, who were non-people to their rulers, valued only for providing the labor needed to satisfy the gluttonous appetites of the elite, or to serve in the armies of conquest or defense. And the same game goes on today. The problem is that undying urge ever resists tyranny. If it cannot overthrow the power which forged its chains, one of two things happens. Either ever more stringent master-slave relations result in apathy and retreat from the harsh reality, or those serfs with a strong reflex of freedom flee to escape the tyranny. They move out from under the oppression and create new centers of growth, and the pattern repeats. It was just such induced mitosis which was the impetus for creation of this new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. those who fled that particular tyranny held, quote, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, unquote, long enough to establish a government which protected liberty and provided a standard for all men everywhere to emulate. From the beginning, that government was under attack by men still possessed of the desire for pelf and power. From the beginning, these self-appointed elitists knew that they could never reassert the power their appetites demanded, so long as there was one piece of territory remaining to which the oppressed could escape. Oof, this, boy, did this ever tie into the Samuel Morse book that I read on my show. Wow. Always their lust for power would be denied unless they ruled the world. How they set about to realize their impossible dream has been the subject of many a pamphleteer, and not a few books. Today the plan they devised has advanced so far that it can no longer be denied that there is such a group with such a goal and deeply involved in the machinery of all governments of the world. There is general knowledge in the United States, in particular, of several of the most prominent present organizations promoting their, quote, new international economic order, unquote. The New World Order. There you go. It has become so evident that such is the case that the establishment itself is bringing out books, articles, and other information, not just admitting their existence, but implying that they have already won their battle and they are in control. This is a strategic move worthy of Sun Tzu, but it has come either too late or too soon. Too soon because at the time Richard Rovere admitted the existence of that quote-unquote benevolent society known as the Council on Foreign Relations, the American people weren't ready to hand over their inheritance to these kindly, intelligent, knowledgeable, dedicated, capable, quote-unquote internationalists. Too late because by the time it became generally known, too many Americans had become roused over the usurpations of their heritage to permit them to lie down and play dead. Too soon because too many Americans still know in their hearts that there is no place on earth offering a better life than that provided by the United States Constitution. Too late because too many Americans once more believe that it would be better to be dead than led into slavery. Many of those Americans still need to know who is doing this to them, and why and how, if they are not to be tricked once more into trusting false promises, false hopes, false moves, and false faces. It is our purpose in this book to expose some of the myths about this scheme, because then a strategy is revealed which began about 100 years ago and which is still being used today. That strategy includes deliberate crises created to achieve the goal, resulting in 2 world wars, 2 police actions, quote-unquote, brush wars all over the map, and uncounted dozens of confrontations between citizens and officials. Only a general understanding of the full portent of current events, with the righteous indignation that understanding would cause, can bring a halt to this assault on civilization. Chapter 3. The Impossible Dream. They all had more money than they could ever use themselves, those men who dreamed the impossible dream at the turn of this 20th century. They had power, each in his own circle of influence, but it seemed it was not enough. When you have all the money you need, and more than you could even count in a lifetime, there is not much satisfaction in trying for still more, especially since money creates money, especially when you own the Federal Reserve. When what you own is incalculable, Its self-enrichment makes adding to it, through personal effort, an exercise in futility. But power, now that is something else. It is like a drug. Wow. Maureen Heaton, you've been reading George Orwell. It sounds just like the third and last book within 1984. Oh boy. It gives a sense, power gives a sense of exalted personal worth far beyond merit. Once tasted, the urge for more power is irresistible to some people. Each additional taste of power creates a drive for more, until life without it seems useless. The dream was not original with these men, nor was theirs the same dream shared by the general populace. Keeping in mind that the dream has apparently been around as long as man himself, the actual mechanics of the present effort to turn it into reality can be arbitrarily determined to have begun in the first decade of the 20th century. Admittedly, it is impossible to compile all the pieces of such a mammoth undertaking as this in a single tome. So it is submitted as a beginning that what is reported in this book is, quote-unquote, taken out of context. Selection of the salient information has been based on the premise of the public, quote-unquote, need to know, that intelligence, which is vital to regain the firm foundation in the lawful government of these United States. The basic strategy underlying all revolutionary moves is deceit. It is not necessary to point out each and every instance where this strategy is used. It is pandemic, and that fact should become part of the intelligence considered in any confrontation on any front. With that as the point of beginning, two vital areas of strategy will be traced. The first is, quote-unquote, re-education of the public. The second, reorganization of government. Since time began, men have dreamed of utopia, and throughout history, attempts have been made to form, quote-unquote, ideal societies. All such efforts have failed because of the inherent nature of man. Part of the cause of failure is that men are not angels, and it would take angels to realize utopia. A large part of the cause of failure, though, is that some men are closer to Satan than to angels, and these are willing to use that age-old dream of heaven on earth to their personal advantage. It would seem that the powerful men who spearheaded the present movement toward, quote-unquote, universal peace, made a conscious decision to turn the dream of the common man for a world of cooperation into a nightmare of a forced collective managed and controlled by agents of their own choosing. With utopia as a stated goal, these modern Machiavellians use the inborn desires which are present to a greater or lesser degree in every man to extend their power and influence over the world, all the world, and all its peoples. The men who framed the Constitution of the United States had tried in a productive way to prepare a climate where the dream, that dream, could be realized by everyone with it, with initiative and desire, without negating the rights of others. Those wise men knew that, in the final analysis, it would depend on the generations to come whether or not they would realize that dream. It has been a source of wonder that, with the exception of Liberia, no major effort has ever been made to extend the influence of the American dream. That path held real promise of making the dream a reality for all mankind. Chapter 4, The Germ of Corruption. Reactionaries who would take the world back to feudalism suborned the sources from which their intended victims could expect to obtain information. The schools, the press, magazines, libraries, TV, radio, but that was not enough. They knew it was also essential that all knowledge be adapted to deny their victims the foundation on which they could stand as a free people. That foundation would include knowing the nature of their heritage and, especially, the nature of the threat to it. It would also include some conception of the source of that threat. This being so, branches of the movement to subvert all governments under which there was any taint of liberty began systematically to remove source material from the libraries and to revise history and rewrite textbooks and diminish the training of teachers so they knew how to teach but not what to teach. Before all this could happen, however, the memory of what went before had to be watered down. Consider, in America, while the generation still lived which fired the shot heard round the world, there was a jealous guardianship of their hard-won freedom from tyranny. The second generation of Americans learned from their sires firsthand the heroic tales of the struggle, and grew to be citizens worthy of their fathers. By the time the third generation of citizens of the United States took their place in history, most of the giants of the Revolution had become part of history, and the stories of their valiant fight were no longer colored with personal remembrances. Liberty had become the norm in America, and the oppression which lit the flame of revolt was dimmed by distance. But there was another factor contributing to the lessening of an alert guardianship over the heritage so unique in all time. The quote-unquote nobility never accepted the revolt of their underlings. Wow, this is really tying in with that Samuel Morse book. Not just in the United States, but even more strongly in their own territories. The revolution in France, which began in much the same manner as that in America, with at least equal cause, was turned from its course, just as was done in Russia a century later. In both these incidents, the movement became a carnage, and the revolt of the people there was used to reinstate a rule by an elite. The germs of corruption which decimated both the French patriots and their former oppressors grew by what they fed on. The new elite created carriers of the disease and sent them out all over Europe, to England, and even across the ocean, systematically to attack the ideas underlying the moral rejuvenation of the natural rights of man. Wow. Maureen Heaton sounds like she's talking about the Jesuits. Little does she know she is, but I can tell looking at the paragraphs coming up, she didn't know about them. Here goes. If she only knew. Robert Owen began his crusade for cooperation, he called it, in England, and carried his red banner to America. Out of the sick mind of Isidore Auguste Marie Francis Xavier Comte came the birth of social science, quote-unquote, and the positive philosophy, both of which undergird, quote-unquote, scientific socialism. Sounds like that book from the Collins brothers, Scientific Dictatorship. The so-called communist movement began in Europe. After sowing the seeds of the 1848 revolt, Karl Marx was sent to England, there to prepare the handbook designed to ensnare the most unlikely candidates, the working men of the world, into support of the attack against themselves. In England, the Fabian Society was created to obtain entry into the world of academe, adding pressure from above to pressure from below, as well as centralized direction for the strategies of the movement. These are but a few of the thrusts directed against the spirit of independence, just beginning to shed its light on a dark world. Oh boy, Maureen Heaton, I wish you were still around. I'd love to interview you and tell you that Samuel Morse already wrote about this in 1834, 1835, and he told you it was the Jesuits who were spearheading, directing all of this. Wow. Back to the book. There were others, and from each of them, sycophants spread out, infiltrating colleges and universities with their radicalism, entering political arenas to color the laws red, penetrating social and religious groups, infecting all with whom they came in contact with their sick creed. By the time the 20th century began, the stage was set for the beginning of what may be the last act as the quote-unquote economic royalists began to take their places on stage, or rather, behind the scenes. On stage were their puppets. Hey, hear, hear, Miss Heaton, right on. Excuse me. You knew. Our presidents are puppets. Even Ron Paul, folks. Just a few at first, then growing in number. As this act began, the war was on in earnest, as one step after another took them toward their goal, almost without constraints. By mid-century, though, they began to meet substantive resistance, which continues to grow and is beginning to have an effect. Is it enough? Only time will tell. Mid-century, huh? That's right about the time George Orwell wrote his warning novel. Both of them, Animal Farm and 1984. Okay, Chapter 5, A Yardstick for Truth. Unless one lived through the strange years which history is recording as the time of, quote-unquote, the anti-communist hysteria, the situation today is certainly puzzling. It is analogous to being dropped off on some uncharted planet out in space, a planet occupied by people with another language, other cultures, other habits, and other goals. Those problems would be multiplied if such a visitor had been given a false briefing on the conditions to be found on this mythical planet. There'd be no way to tell which were the good guys and which were the bad guys. No yardstick with which to measure truth. No guide for personal conduct. If the inhabitants of that other world also were bent on preventing understanding of their ways, the visitor from Earth would be hard put to cope with it all. Especially would this be true if there were some marked discrepancies in whatever information was made available by the denizens of that other world, not knowing what was truth and what propaganda was, the visitor could not be faulted for being beset with doubts, and chaos and confusion could be the expected result. The only recourse for such a stranger in an alien land would be to defer to his own reaction to the messages being sent, and to sort out for himself those which were consonant with his beliefs, principles, and past experience, and those which were dissonant, and used these to guide him. This is the situation in which Earthlings find themselves in today. They are strangers in their own lands. Fortunately, there is an echo of the situation which existed during the beginnings of this country. There are those among us, just as there were then, who carry memories of the past. Some were even part of it, and they can keep what was in focus. Some of these have kept copious records of events which led to today's situation. These records are not dependent on experience, hearsay, or linguistic problems. They provide an accurate and sequential history of the interventions which have advanced this revolution. These records and memories irrefutably provide a yardstick both for truth and for measuring the validity of personal values. Many of these who remember are striving mightily to dispel the effects of current constraints on truth and understanding, and to chart paths through this wonderland of confusion. Even for these, though, it takes some doing to brush the debris of the tangled web of camouflage from paths which still exist, and to bypass those destroyed. Hardest of all is the choice as to which path promises to be most likely to lead out of the morass which impedes both vision and progress. During those years when the preponderant voice of the people was heard through the various departments of government, many official investigations of the proliferating problems were conducted. At that time, reliable official reports were issued on subversive activity, identifying people, movements, strategies, tactics, and ideologies involved. Gradually, as the quote-unquote government assumed a shared interest with the subversives, the voice of the people speaking through representatives has been muted. As conflicting messages began to issue from the labyrinthine chambers of officialdom, citizens began to fill the void left, as the voices of their representatives were stilled, and the news media failed to report the issues involved in the conflict. Networks of information outlets were created, some reliable, some not, which covered the country, with the mixed messages from quote-unquote government, the media, and volunteers. It is not to be wondered at that the great multitude not directly involved have been unable to differentiate among them. No wonder they drift into apathy, move in non-productive circles. The mass media offers little hope for remedy. To the contrary, the mass media is responsible for much of the problem. The handful of sources of reliable information cannot wholly make up for that, as they do not have mass distribution, nor financial resources to achieve it. Of some considerable importance is the fact that the truth sometimes hurts, and when the truth involves those who are in positions of power, either the truth suffers, or the messenger carrying it does. The truth must be carefully and conscientiously sought if one is to avoid being trapped in the meshes of the subversive network. Many of the quote-unquote remedies which gain widespread support today are, in fact, of benefit to the revolutionary cause. With general knowledge of the interlocking connections behind these quote-unquote remedies, they could be prevented from diverting productive effort. The world today needs the capabilities and the courage of a Patrick Henry to seek, quote, the truth and the whole truth, to know the worst and to prepare for it, unquote. Okay, we're going to call it right there, and we're just almost up to an hour, and that was chapters 1 through 5 of Maureen Heaton's manuscript, The Impossible Dream. If I told you now, if I told you now, if I told you now, how would it help? If I told you now.
told you now, I'll leave my children here. If I told you now, I'll just have you through.
This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. Pass you through. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world. This world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before.
I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world.
That is the way things are.